You're listening to IsraelScene.com, and I'm Steve.
And this is Yoram.
And we're two guys who are passionately in love with the country in a more abstract sort of way.
But have a lot of criticism about the reality. Yeah, it's a tricky place to be.
Wow, man. I love this place, but there's so much that seems broken. It's sometimes almost overwhelming to think about it.
Well, it's not only here, Steve. My feeling is that we are a broken people. We are a very wounded people. And over the last years, and certainly the immediate last years, 50 to 100 years ago, we've lost a tremendous amount of our vital bodily fluids in the form of people, of our people who have been killed and murdered and so on. And we've never had the opportunity to heal. I mean, my personal experience when it comes to my own healing has always been to be somewhere quiet, and to be somewhere where I can allow the energy that my body has to repair itself. And that's a process, and I take it for granted that that's a process that we do when we heal ourselves. And that's something we've not had an opportunity to do now for many, many years, perhaps in the United States to a degree. But certainly since we've come here, and from before when we came here, from our experience in Europe and our experience in the Muslim world, was very difficult and was very wounding. And we came here as a very wounded people, and we haven't had 10 minutes of peace and quiet and opportunity to heal ourselves. And that's one of the reasons that we keep falling into so many, that we have so many problems here, and we keep falling into so many holes that you know, in an attempt to survive, we end up doing things that do not necessarily contribute to our survival.
So I think you brought up a really important point. So what is my day? My day is in the morning. Most mornings, I'll sit there, put on my, do my orthodox side of me, which I want to mention. I might put on my tefillin in the morning, which is the phylacteries for those who are unfamiliar with it, and of course, email that you sent me, which I thought was very curious, stating that some major acupuncture magazine had discussed tefillin and saying that the points of contact with the body. Is the same points that the needles would be put into the body for encouraging or experiencing spirituality and peace. Interesting point, sidebar to this. And I sit quietly and meditate, pray, and whatever for at least 45 minutes to an hour in the morning. So my centering is there, but I don't find that in the general population here. What I mean is that we seem to be moving from crisis to crisis, most of them self-inflicted, because there isn't the planning. There isn't some kind of plan even when it comes to settlement within the Galil, settlement within Negev, settlement anywhere, when it comes to health care, when it comes to all the basic social needs that this country has that has to be dealt with, must be dealt with on a governmental level. And we just seem to be helter-skelter with it. I'm so bummed out by how an intelligent group of people can be so stupid in the way we function. And I wonder if it's just the adrenaline rush of dealing with crisis that gives you a sense of aliveness. But it's sometimes you hit, more often you miss, and it affects everybody.
Well, I think the issue is one in which we haven't had the time to slow down, to quiet down, and you know, to plot our course, to think deeply about what we're doing and why we're doing it and what would be the right thing to do next. We are in a state of crisis because, in part, in no small part, because we're constantly under attack and have been from the day we were born in that sense. And it wears on people. Last night we were watching, I mean, you were home in your house, I was in my house, a program on the special Israeli forces, the units of the army, the super elite, the frogmen, and the commando, various commando units, and their incredible accomplishments, and their incredible, you know, Entebbe, and all sorts of amazing things that were done. The capture of that arms boat, the Karine Eba, the frog, you know, on and on and on. And I couldn't help thinking, all right, now enough, you know, like let's stop having to do that, because it takes a tremendous cost of the people who are involved in these things, and they're young people, are really, in many cases, crippled by the training that it requires in order to be able to accomplish these amazing missions.
Or at least have the skills that they use in planning these missions, which more often than not are great success at great risk. Take that planning experience, take that determination to form some kind of a vision so that you can go out and meet a goal. And if you don't meet it, you adjust it along the way. If we have any planning at any level in this country, it's certainly not conveyed to the public. I don't know anybody out there in the street who has any idea that there's a plan for something that they can say, well, you know what, here's a plan. I may disagree with it, but here is the plan that the government has. The government, if it has a plan, it's top secret.
Well, this is one of the issues that's come up very strongly now in terms of Ehud Olmert, because he came into power very much on the basis of the plan to begin the withdrawal process from Yehuda and Shomron and to begin to establish permanent borders in one form or another. And that went. And that went not because he changed his mind. It went because of the attack from Lebanon, which changed the whole country around, which just made it completely absurd to consider another withdrawal, because at the same time that this attack from Lebanon was going on, there was also the attack from Gaza, which is the other place we withdrew from. So it's like being battered from hither to yon, and there's no opportunity to pause, and there's no opportunity to think things out, and the result is not good.
And this latest Gaza project, there may be planning here, but the bottom line is, again, there's an assault by rockets that are hitting Israeli towns, specifically Sderot, and other areas around there. And as a result of that, we're forced into a position to act and to secure some kind of security.
Or
eliminate, essentially what I feel is going on, is to eliminate the incredible amount of ammunition and weapons that have been smuggled into Egypt, thanks to Egypt and its neglect, because it really doesn't care. And from what we gather in the newspapers around the world, the Egyptian police and military are paid handsomely to look the other way. So we are in a really catch-22 situation there. But make a plan. Say, hey, listen. And let everybody know about the plan. We're going in there until you stop. The moment you stop, we will leave. None of that is apparent. It's like off from the seat of our pants. And that's more worrisome than anything else. I also feel, in regard to that, is that there's an element, obviously, within the Palestinian Authority or the Palestinians that, you know, this, I wish we could have all of Israel. I really want all of Israel. So let's do something to make it as irritable to them as possible, with the hope that they too will leave like they left Lebanon, like they left Gaza. So all the messages are just so in such disarray. The wrong signals are being sent, and there's no understanding of that at a high level. At a higher level, these elected officials are elected to do the thinking, with the input from the experts, quote unquote, within the country and outside the country.
And then you
and
add
come up
to
with
that
something.
It's the continual process of the international community to totally ignore the agreements that we come to under great pressure. We accepted the idea that we would withdraw from the corridor between Gaza and Sinai. Condoleezza Rice was here and went through all those changes, and that happened. And now it's become a very porous border, and there's tons of military and explosives being smuggled in. And the United States isn't that concerned. You know, they've gone on to other
well,
issues.
It's not their sons and daughters that are potentially dying here. Excuse me. The greatest, and in one sense, as great as an ally America is, and it is a great ally, at the same time, we sometimes, because it's the only ally that we put our fate with, as a result of that, we're sitting in a situation where we are not making the decisions in our best interest.
And not always can we get away with making the decisions in our best interest, For instance, trying to keep track of the smuggling from Syria into Lebanon.
We did, but no one cares.
So now they're threatening us because we're trying to keep track of it through the Air Force by photographing it, not necessarily bombing it.
And they're not even interested.
And that was part of the agreement, right? We left Lebanon. We stopped that whole war business as part of an agreement. And part of the agreement was that there would be no more supply of rockets and missiles from Syria to the Hezbollah. And it's going on. It's going on in front of who's up there, the German Navy and all the UNIFIL soldiers and the Lebanese army. And when we try and keep track of it with from the air, you know,
we're
it doesn't work.
We're slammed for overflights.
It doesn't work.
In Lebanon. And even with Gaza now, the fact is that 99% of the people who supposedly have died in this latest episode were truly terrorists using women as shields. And what do we get from Kofi Annan? He's actually still around. Thank God he's through at the end of December. This is not proportionate. If you kill one, then they kill you one from your side, then you should only kill one from their side. I am baffled by the incredible insanity that comes out of the mouths of people like a Kofi Annan and others, including Europe, the European Union. This is disproportionate. So therefore, we only should kill the equal amount of people that have been maimed and killed on our side. This is screwy logic.
Well,
this is
fuzzy
logic.
It might work if we had a proportionate threat. But we're dealing with a very unproportionate threat. There are 5 million Jews here dealing with a threat of 300 million Arabs. So if you want to talk about proportion and disproportion, there is a very glaring disproportion and one which we cannot ignore. And we're talking about one Jewish state of Israel, and we're talking about something like 22 Muslim Arab states, which is also very disproportionate, not to mention the Muslim, you know, the Muslim conference of all the Muslim states, which is something like 40 Muslim states, all of which may not be militarily antagonistic to us, but all of which have boycott rules, and all of which vote against us at any opportunity and in any forum. And that's also very disproportionate. And I think that Kofi Annan should complain about that.
I don't think he's interested in complaining about that.
I don't either.
I don't think he likes us too much.
So, in conclusion, let me say, I think it brings even stronger to mind that we are in a position where we need to make choices based on priorities. And one of the priorities, one of the choices that we're making now, which is driving me up the wall, and it was this last 2 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks in the Jerusalem Post, different articles pointing to an issue which I think is beyond belief. As I said before, I think one of the great, what will prove to be one of the most significant issues in the aftermath of this last war will be the economic issue and will be the demographic issue. Of how long, how many Jews remain living in the Galilee, living in the north. And one of the things that happened is that there was a lot of damage to private homes, a lot of damage to public buildings, a lot of damage to the agricultural settlements in the north, particularly because the orchardists could not harvest their crops while the missiles were falling. So they lost a lot of money. And the way the agricultural cycle works is you borrow money in the spring, you work and spend the money all summer, and then in the fall you harvest, you pay back your loan, and what's left is called profit. Well, there was nothing at the end of the season to pay back the loan and to call profit, which is what you use to live through the winter, right? Until the next summer when you borrow money and the cycle runs. That's the traditional agricultural cycle. And those people who were in the agriculture business are the people who are holding the land, physically holding the land. And when those people give up because they can't afford it because they're going bankrupt because there's no money, and they leave, the land is not going to remain empty. So several weeks ago in the Jerusalem Post was an article that the government is going to spend 900 million shekels on very high-tech advanced defense systems for what were described as scattered settlements in Judea and Shomron. That's basically a billion shekels is going to go into defending scattered isolated settlements in Yehuda and Shomron, while that billion shekels will not go in to supporting the north and supporting people remaining in the north and developing it even further than it was at the time. Now I read also that the number of academics, because there's a lessening over the years of support for academic institutions, that the number of positions that open each year
are less.
So that people who are getting graduate degrees in you know, the sciences, humanities, and so on, there are fewer and fewer jobs available to them here.
So they're being educated here, and they're going abroad. And so the payoff is being reaped by America and European nations' educational...
Right, and all the education that they got here, and they're going to pay taxes and contribute to the culture, to the societies, not here, but abroad. Not only that, but there's now developing a very, very intense competition for educated, well-educated people all over the world. I mean, not all over the world, but particularly in Europe and America and in those parts of the Far East where the technology industries are thriving. So the competition for manpower is beginning. It's really in its early period, in its early stages, now being recognized as on its way to becoming a major issue, a major brain drain issue of the intelligent, educated people from whether it's Israel or India or Egypt for that matter or wherever it is, being drawn to the United States, being drawn to places like Japan, where the salaries are going to be very high, and of course the houses are nicer and the cars are bigger and all those other attractions. So we're really facing an incredible series of concentric issues and problems which are not going to make us any stronger in the face of what many of us recognize to be a developing threat by the Arab world, the Muslim world.
So in a sense, you're saying that we're imploding through our own neglect.
And through phenomena that are happening on a planetary level, that of which we are, you know, just a small corner. Mm-hmm. But those things also will impact on us. So I really feel that we need to make some very serious priority decisions about where we are going to invest our resources. We are not a tremendously wealthy country when it comes to resources. We don't have the oil, we don't have the gold, we don't have the prairies, we don't have the amount of water that flows through the Mississippi. Our resources are very limited, and although the Jews rule the world, we really don't have, in comparison to other people, we don't have an endless supply of financial backing. So we have to make very strong, and in many cases, very unpleasant decisions, difficult decisions, which people experience in their families. I mean, I would like to have potentially a better car, a bigger house, or travel more, whatever it happens to be. But on the other hand, that's not what I can do.
You have a budget, and you have to...
You have to stay with it.
If you want to be responsible, you stay within the budget.
So the issue, I believe, with...
We don't stay within the budget here.
With Yehudah and Shomron particularly, and with support, although it's now lessened finally for the for certain rather unproductive elements within our own society, I think we have to make very hard decisions on how we spend, on where we spend our money, on what we invest in. And some of the places that we should no longer spend our money will be difficult for people to accept. But I think it's a Zionist imperative that we make those choices, and we make the right choices. We make the choices to develop within the six-day border, whether it's in the Galil or in the Negev, and to invest in, I thought, a billion shekels that they're going to spend out there would be very nicely spent in the north to create a university, which not only would keep people young people who already live there or brought up there in the neighborhood, but would draw people from other parts of the country to move to the north, to go to the university, and then potentially to live there.
In fact, there was comments made recently that many of the kids who were going to the university in the north, Tel Chai or whatever, stopped going because they didn't have the resources to pay for it, because they didn't have their summer jobs, because they were being bombed by Hezbollah in the north. Where is the government to help them? So my question is, now that we've bitched and in a loving way, because we care so much for this place, what do we do? Where do we go from here? How do we do this? I mean, it seems so simple to us, and it is simple in many ways. It just takes a desire to transcend personal ambition and greed for the betterment of the whole. And this is a problem that we have here, because I'm not quite sure that we really have, at least those in power really can understand that they must transcend their own personal desires for the greater good. And boy, when you listen to the people in the Knesset, it's very disheartening, because you wonder what planet they're on, and you know they're not working for me or you.
I have a feeling that this is a problem that is being experienced in places other than Israel at this point in time.
But we don't have the luxury of a huge, vast place called the United States or Europe where you can make a few mistakes and somehow, over a short period of time, you can adjust. You make a slight mistake here, and it can cost you an entire country. Not only economic, but the effects of the economics based on the hostility surrounding areas will precipitate a collapse of some kind, which we saw in the North. I mean, the Lebanon affair, I mean, absolutely we should do something, and we should have done something about the kidnapping of our soldiers. But what? Someone sit down and design a plan as to how this is supposed to go? And if they did, they certainly didn't tell half the people that were out in the street risking their lives in the villages as we're coming crossing over. Our soldiers are just, like, in a sense, stranded. It wasn't so much what Hezbollah was doing. It was so much that we knew what Hezbollah had and didn't even communicate it to the people on the ground, the soldiers on the ground. I mean, this is the frustrating problem I have here, is that somehow it's like a telephone, you know? You have an initial message, and the time it gets to the end of the line, it's completely changed. The problem is the truth, when it first was transmitted, never seems to come out. Somehow it gets waylaid into a hole, into a design and a pattern and a matrix that has no reality to what's actually happening. And as a result, we suffer with loss of life, we suffer with humiliation, unnecessarily, including in Lebanon, including with Hezbollah. I mean, the latest reports are showing that we actually did know they had the bunkers and so forth, and this information was never conveyed to the officers on the ground in Lebanon. Now, that's an embarrassment, and no one's paying for it. Everyone gets off the hook. You have a defense minister who I try very hard to give him every benefit of the doubt in terms of his capacity and competency. But I'm hard-pressed to believe that Peretz is still defense minister today. I'm hard-pressed to believe that the folks in many of the ministries have a right to be there and are competent. I mean, this is like the PETA principle. Everybody gets elevated to their level of incompetency, and that's it. And they all function accordingly. So what do you get on the ground is you get total incompetence, and we're suffering for it.
There are a lot of people now talking about the amazing lack, the deep lack of talent, of a capability and ability and commitment on the part of the political level, the people who are engaged in politics, and all the parties.
Yeah, but that's across the globe as far as I'm concerned.
That's across the globe, and it's certainly across the line here. I wanted to mention, it was another interesting item out of the Jerusalem Post. It was a headline about Hezbollah, and it said that Hezbollah was surprised, but they were prepared for the war that came along. They were surprised that Israel reacted so strongly, but ultimately they were prepared to deal with whatever Israel had to throw at them. Well, we, on the other hand, were not surprised. We kept talking for years about all their rockets, but we weren't prepared.
Well, it seems
like really the totally wrong setup in order for success or even for survival.
And then we set up, and then we set an agreement with the UN to send in forces, you know, from all over Europe to come in there and to police. Well, this is an interesting phenomenon because in today's post, I was reading an article, or maybe it was Ynet, Idol Achronot, Ynet.com, where they're saying, here we had an incredibly strategic alliance with Germany. We have because of the nature of what took place during World War II, and we put ourselves in a risk situation with our closest and greatest supporter in Europe by putting their troops on the front line with us. And as a result, there's already tension between us. Unnecessary. Self-created. Germany begging out of sending troops for fear that we'd be on a collision course. And what do we do? No, everything's cool. Come on in. I mean, no one thought this out. Everybody believed that the UN was actually going to stop the transfer of arms. France didn't have any illusion at all. They just want a secure Sonora in government. The U.S. saying to Israel, listen, we want the Sonora government. Who said the Sonora government's the right government? Maybe it isn't the best in our best interest to have Sonora still as prime minister of Lebanon. But it's not our interest that we're concerned about. We're concerned about everybody else's interest. And then we get screwed in the bargain. So we don't have any stability here. We have no ability in terms of our commitment as to what we want to do here. And that's because I truly believe there's no long-term planning, no short-term view and vision of what we need to do immediately to take care of the immediate problems, like you suggested, in the north, which is critical and crucial. And it's beautiful up in the Galil. People would come there in a minute if they had opportunity, which we can create there for them. But we don't seem to have it. But, like, again, Yehuda Shimron, someone has the purse there. Someone has the money within the government. And you'd think that Likud was in power right now, the way we're spending money there. For what? For what? It's like throwing money down the toilet, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, you have to remember that Kadima is basically Likud. Most of those people are from the Likud. And they're following in that footstep, and I don't think they can see a way out. Now, I propose that they withdraw the settlements, the communities, the civilians from Yudan Shomron and leave the army, because it's obvious we can't just withdraw everybody like we did in Gaza, or we're going to end up with Gaza East. But there's no reason for the civilians to be there. And they're the ones that cost the money.
And certainly there's no reason
for
the outposts to be there.
And to spend $1 billion to defend them.
Exactly. Let the military, again, the problem that I felt we did in Gaza was that we rightfully withdrew, as far as I'm concerned, because it was in our best interest. The problem is, no one said to withdraw from Gaza, withdraw the civilians from Gaza, but maintain a hold until there's some kind of negotiation. And somehow we got it wrong. And we're getting it wrong again in Yehuda Shimron. So what are we going to do? We say now we're not going to withdraw because it shows take it as a sign of weakness. They take the territory and then they lob more stuff at us. So instead of saying, okay, now we're going to change it a bit, we're going to withdraw the populations from the isolated areas but maintain the army's presence so that you can't screw us with our willing to withdraw until we come to some kind of agreement, God knows when that can be, Hamas chokes on the possibility of recognizing Israel's existence because it then puts at risk everything that they have stated they believe in Palestine from the Jordan to the Mediterranean, but they're willing to do a hudna for 10 years. And so we're even contemplating this hudna, you know, and with the idea, well, 10 years from now, the next generation or whatever will deal with what that possibility will bring. And in the interim, Hamas may change its colors and stripes. That's one of the articles that appeared in one of the newspapers today. I say, okay, if you even want to go with that premise, make a plan. Decide, okay, what are we going to do with this? How is this going to play out? All Europe wants is for us to make some kind of peace. All U.S. wants from us is to make some kind of peace, because this link to the land here as the basis of conflict, when it has nothing to do with land, it has to do with theology. And as a result, out of that theology, a political stand, a political vision. And that's been the problem from day one. Everybody's talking about Palestine, Israel, land, the leftists in America complaining about Israel, the anti-Zionist Jews, the anti-Zionist non-Jews, everybody. If Israel would just leave, everything would be fine. You know, it's that same continual viewpoint of that the Jews are the problem. They've always been the problem. But the thing is that they're not the problem. It has nothing to do with the Jews. It has to do with the vision of Islam. And as long as Islam sees the infidel as a problem in its vision and quest for its imperialistic ideals of conquering Europe, conquering all of the Middle East. And they're doing a wonderful job in Europe, and they're not even firing one shot. Not one single shot. They're just occupying and populating Europe. It's a brilliant move. This was the greatest jihad so far in modern times. Without firing a shot, they are creating more chaos.
Well, Steve, how do they say, you've come a long way, baby?
I'm willing to change when I see the stripes are different than I thought they would appear.
I reckon.
It's hard. It's very hard. Because, you know, yeah.
No, go ahead.
The tension between what I hope would happen. I mean, I would desire and hope that really that there would be a strong element within the Palestinian Authority that really they would see, if they would only realize and give up the notion of conquering us all, and they could drop a little of the hatred. And I know it's difficult in the West Bank. I know it's difficult in Gaza. I know it's no fun being, quote-unquote, occupied. But the bottom line is, that's the reality. And we want to extricate ourselves from this reality as quickly as possible, for the most part. And they would love nothing more than, I think, to be separated from us, although I'm not quite sure that's really the case, which is a dilemma. If only they would get some, if only they would develop and move in an area, in a vision that would allow them this opportunity. But they, for some reason, you know, I keep going back to Golda Meir, right? Or I don't know if it was Meir or Iban, who said that they always miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity.
That was Iban.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. And I don't, and it creates more of a dilemma for us.
That's the point. I mean, the point is obviously not a Palestinian state. It's not, I mean, they certainly had the opportunity when they were ruled by Jordan and Egypt. They had the opportunity recently, but that is not the goal of the leadership. And the community, the people follow the leadership. There really doesn't seem to be much of an individuality going on there.
But that's the same thing, if I may, in Jordan now and Egypt. I've been reading, too, that the problem with us and Jordan is we have an incredible alliance in security and intelligence, and we share it, but it's only between government to government. It's not between people and people. The people in Jordan, under the right circumstance, would overthrow the government, the king, in a second. It's majority now a Palestinian, not Bedouin. And as a result, we would be in a hostile situation. Egypt, for sure, we all know that. But it's a relationship between a government, our government, and a government that's teetering on collapse in Egypt, and the only thing that keeps them there is a military that is, I don't know how competent they may be. Maybe they're more competent than they really let on.
Well, in repression, they're obviously very
excellent.
Competent.
No, the Arabs know how to repress well. They know how to use their military, and they don't mess around. Forget about civil rights. You know, we know in Syria, they didn't like a situation, and what, a number of years ago, they just literally destroyed a whole town.
25,000 people.
25,000 people slaughtered, and I didn't hear anything from anybody in the UN, certainly not in Europe, you know? I mean, and even in Jordan, when they had the whole number of years ago when the PLO, remember when they threw the PLO out? They killed half of them and threw the rest of them out. I mean, Egypt in a flash.
There is, Steve, I think there is another agenda. There is simply another agenda going on here. I've called it a historical conspiracy, and because it's not a conspiracy of a bunch of people sitting around and making a decision or working out a skillful and clever plan to defeat us or to destroy us. It's a conspiracy that has to do with a long historical process. It's several thousand years old. It's consistent. They never miss a beat. And it's just continuing. It doesn't really feel like there's a whole lot that can be done to oppose it. The best we can do is to make decisions that are appropriate at this point in time and space for our own well-being, not whether it helps the Arabs or it hinders the Arabs. We have to make decisions based on what we need to do for our well-being, and there'll be difficult decisions. And the longer it takes to make them, the more difficult the decisions come. And in the meantime, all the decisions, all the choices we have to make are between bad and worse. There are appears to be no more good choices. This is exactly what happened in Lebanon. It's just what's going on in Gaza today. On the one hand, you can't just let them go on and on firing rockets at our civilian population. On the other hand, going in there with the army is not going to solve the problem. It's going to cause a lot of dead Palestinians. It's going to make great video and TV and news of destroyed buildings and destroyed people. So and it's not getting better. I mean, that's part of the thing that we have to understand is that until the only chance we have, and I don't know how really far-reaching that would be, is to start making decisions based on what we need to do for ourselves, even though it'll be hard because there are many people here who don't understand that and who confuse a certain kind of nationalism with a certain kind of violence and strength with not giving in and with just holding everything.
And vice versa, the confusion of being compassionate to your enemy, to the suffering, and at the same time relinquishing your interests for dealing with that. And it doesn't mean it's one or the other. You can do both.
Well, it's very difficult, and I think the separation barrier is a perfect point in reference. It's ugly beyond belief, as you see it coming across the country where it's just a fence, and around Jerusalem where I see it, where it's this huge concrete wall. It is incredibly ugly, and yet it's saving Jewish lives, and for those who care, it's saving Palestinian lives. And it was a very hard decision to make, and they still haven't, you know, decided to finish it and to get it done and to do it and to finish it. But that's an example of a difficult and unpleasant decision, which ultimately is in the interest of everybody. It turns out to be even in the Palestinian interest to have that barrier there, as well as in our own interest. I think we need to play Oseh Shalom and have some nice music.
So before we go out, some positive.
Something positive.
Something positive about living here.
Right.
Believe me, with all its surus, with all the problems, and with all this, there is a dynamic, an energy here. Because as much as things are so critically messed up, there is a hope here too. There is a tikvah. There is a hope here. There is the fact of living here in a Jewish state that's forever dynamic and growing, and always the potential for making it a better place to live.
So maybe we should go out with hatikvah.
Oh, say shalom and hatikvah.
Well, say shalom, we can do it again.
Yeah.
Because that's our hope, is they'll say shalom, and hatikvah is the other part of the hope.
Yes, so we should have peace, hope.
And we should have seichel.
And we should have, yes.
A little wisdom.
A little wisdom. So that's our Torah for today. You're listening to IsraelScene.com. I'm Steve.
This is Yoram.
And have a great week. Shavua Tov.